I think I tried to avoid working as long as possible and spent a long time traveling, and then tried to find something that I felt would make a difference to the world. I was very young, idealistic, and civil service seemed like a good place to try and make things happen on quite a big scale. And international development was a fabulous place to work. I was under Clare Short at the time, and it was really doing great things, and that was very inspiring. And then there were a number of things happened. The Iraq War happened, and there was a change of ministers. I transferred for some different experience into the Office of the Deputy Prime Minister, where I did work on social exclusion in the UK. And I very much realised that if you want to make a difference in the civil service, it takes really quite a long time. Policies take years to have any effect, and to be senior enough to see your policies actually make any headway took years of getting promoted and so on. And the realisation came to me that the things that I liked about my job in the civil service was when I went out and met people and talked to people about their experiences and shared their lives. And my family has a medical background, and I'd always not done medicine for that reason. But I did quite a lot of thinking about what I wanted to do and decided that I liked people too much and wanted to do something where I really saw a change every day when I went to work. I think you can never actually imagine what it's like doing medicine before you start, but it's certainly very rewarding.
What did you imagine? I mean, obviously you had the experience of your family and what they must have communicated to you.
I'm not entirely sure what I imagined. I think I thought it would be much more clear-cut and that the answers would be straightforward once you knew the medicine. And that's very rarely the case. There's a lot of judgment in it, and there is science obviously underlying it, but there's also a lot of judgment about what's important to the individual, what they want from their treatment. Would they rather put up with the medical condition, or would they rather take a lot of tablets? I like that human aspect to it as well.
By the way, how were your folks when you said to them, I'm going to train to be a doctor?
Well, my father told me that he was glad that I'd taken his advice at last.
It's sickening when they do
Yeah.
that, isn't it? I bet they must be very proud of you now. You're in fourth year of training.
So I'm 4 years after qualifying, yes.
So, how has it been for you, the change? Do you ever wake up and regret moving out of the civil service?
No, is the short answer.
Despite the long hours and the
Despite
night
the long hours.
shifts and
The hours are not too bad. It certainly can be stressful. As a medical trainee, so I've been working in general medicine, which covers all kind of aspects of conditions affecting organs like the heart, the lungs, the gut, and so on. You get a lot of responsibility in that quite early on, depending where you work, and I think that is quite stressful. It's not the hours so much, but you do leave a night shift or even a long day feeling utterly drained, but often in a good way.
How do you deal with the, what seems to me as an outsider, how do you deal with the almost constant sense of responsibility for people's lives, and sometimes quite literally their lives?
I think, although you do have responsibility for someone's life, I think if you're conscientious and you work as your team, you recognise your limitations, and when you're junior, you ask for help. You talk to your senior colleagues when you're unsure about something. I think that that enables you to feel that there's a safety net behind what you do. My personal view is that people who don't ask for help are the ones that you should be worried about. And I don't think that's true of many people. I think most doctors recognise where their limitations lie.
And we made you angry at the beginning of
I'm
the
afraid you
week.
did
Oh,
on
PM, I am
Saturday.
so angry at you wrote.
I know, and I love PM. I think it's such a good news programme.
What did we do?
So on Saturday, my husband was out having a boys' day out, and so I was sat at home on my own listening to the radio, and PM came on. And
You tried to get up to turn it off, but by that stage it had
well,
started.
it had started, and I heard the headline, and I thought, oh, this is one of my pet hobby horse subjects, if you like. My friends are all bored of me talking about death. And the first thing that I heard on the headline was a man who'd had clearly a very sad experience of his father dying. But the language he used was very emotive, and when it came to the main article, there didn't seem to be a counterpoint to his negative experience, which he was blaming on the Liverpool care pathway.
What do you understand by the Liverpool care pathway? And I suppose as a supplementary thought to that, what do you understand by what it's come to mean in the minds of some people?
Well, I mean, I think the term Liverpool care pathway has become problematic. The Liverpool care pathway, I think, is not well understood by the wider public. It is a document, it is a piece of paper. It guides you through a series of prompts of things that constitute good end-of-life care. At no point does it say you should withdraw food. In fact, it says you should support someone to eat. At no point does it say you should withdraw fluids. It says you should support someone to eat and drink, and you should consider giving them other forms of fluids if they can't. Medication that people have been taking for a long time is often stopped when they go on the Liverpool care pathway, but the reason for that is that there's no point taking a cholesterol tablet if your cholesterol isn't going to be high in 2 years' time because you're going to be dead in a few days. So the language that is used to describe it has made it sound, firstly, the word pathway has made it sound like it's a one-way track to death. And while you use it when you do think that there is an inevitable outcome of death at the end of it, it's not actually one way. There are times when you say, well, we're implementing the features of the Liverpool care pathway for this patient, and people sometimes make an amazing recovery. And then you say, well, actually, this person, we've left them alone, we've supported them to eat and drink, and they've done really well, and actually they're not dying in the next 72 hours, so let's stop that. And I don't think that's well understood by people.
How do you think it's come to have a very negative connotation in some people's minds? As I understand it, and you'll correct me, I'm sure, is that some medical professionals misinterpreted what they should have been doing, and so some things went wrong. The pathway, if you like, wasn't followed as it should have been done. Some people had their food or liquid withdrawn, and that's where the problem lay, perhaps not with the pathway itself, but how it was interpreted. Is that fair?
I think absolutely, and I've posted a number of things on Facebook recently regarding this because it's such a topical thing. And a girl that I went to school with posted the most immensely sad story of her father dying, and she said, I've actually got it in front of me because I wondered if it might be helpful to kind of see how the Liverpool care pathway has been used. I mean, I wasn't there, I don't know how it was used, but the impression I get was that it was misinterpreted in this case. She wrote to me, animals would be treated better, and with my own dad this December it felt as if it went against every natural urge to try and help him and give him what he wanted. We stood there helpless. My dad had wanted a bullet. If we can't do that, at least we could give them water when thirsty, a drip if they can't drink. Not to just felt so wrong. And anyone who's conscious enough to be thirsty and to ask for water should not be denied water. I think some of the talk about withdrawing food and fluids has come about because maybe of poor communication with people, because there are certain changes that happen as people approach death, and people have a reduced need for food and a reduced need for fluids, and often just become very sleepy and spend their days sleeping away and maybe just coming around for a few moments to acknowledge their family, or it depends. I mean, some people are more lucid than others, but people don't often want to drink and don't want to eat. People do often get a very dry mouth, often because their breathing is through their mouth. Part of the Liverpool care pathway is ensuring that people have good mouth care. There are sprays of artificial saliva you can use that are very helpful. You can use these little sponge dipped in water to moisten the mouth, and the nursing staff will clear off crusts, and we make sure that there isn't a problem like oral thrush, which can be very painful. So I think there is probably, because in the UK we don't talk about death, and people don't see death except on television or in a movie where it's not portrayed in any realistic kind of way. People tend to die at a quite elderly age, so you may not see someone die until you're in your 50s, when it's your mum or dad who's 80-something. That it's not a familiar experience of seeing a person's body become frailer and gradually shut down.
What has seeing death taught you?
Every death is an individual experience. It's taught me to recognise that we're all going to die. And I'm very passionate about trying to get people to talk about it, because you're not bringing it any closer by talking about it. You're not being morbid. You're actually opening up possibilities of people to talk about what they want at the end of their lives. And some of the deaths that I've seen that I would class as sort of the best deaths are where people are very accepting of it. And I think that's often easier if there's some concrete diagnosis that you understood to be terminal. So cancer patients, who I've worked with quite a lot, can often know that they're going to likely die of their cancer. and have come to an acceptance around it. And in those cases, it's very dignified sometimes that people have said, that's it, I'm not having any more treatment. I'm going to accept this. I'm going to spend time with my family.
In formulating policy, I suppose, and strategies for dealing with death, if not Liverpool Care Pathway, is it possible to draw up on a few pieces of paper something that would be generally useful to most people, to most health professionals and patients?
Well, my personal hunch is that whatever replaces it will be very similar, because it is just a piece of paper. Hmm. I would always discuss if I was going to use it with somebody. I'd never decide myself either. That would be a decision taken in consultation with a team. I would discuss with family members. And if anyone raised an objection to the use of that particular document, I wouldn't use it, because they will have a memory of what's happened that will go a long time beyond the death. And things that are traumatic to them around a time of grief, I think, become even more traumatic. But I don't think the care that I would give would differ in any way, because you would still look at giving good palliative end-of-life care to somebody. And it doesn't really matter if you have that document. I think the reason for having a document is to try and prompt people to think about all the aspects of what you're trying to provide for someone.
Have you come across families who, a member of whom may have set themselves against, and you said you wouldn't go against their wishes, may have set themselves against, for the best of reasons, doing something like Liverpool Care Pathway, and then after a death which may have been much more ghastly and messy than anyone wanted, did they regret not going down that route?
I've actually never had anyone say that they would not want it used once you explain what it means to use it. And I think that if you provide good end-of-life care, death shouldn't be ugly and nasty and distressing. Sometimes there's nothing you can do to prevent that if something happens very suddenly and very unexpectedly, or if someone has remained in pain until the end despite your attempts to adjust medications. I guess I'm in a slightly strange position because I only see up to the point of death, and then my only other contact with the families is to hand them a death certificate, and I don't know how their bereavement continues after that.
Do you wish you did know?
I think sometimes it would be interesting to see, but obviously you have it's a professional relationship I have with people, even though you obviously become close to some people. I think it's probably a good thing that distance remains.
And we began the conversation by talking about your old job as a civil servant, and you talked about how you were young and idealistic, but you wanted to see the results on a quicker timescale. I mean, you're still young. Do you feel idealistic? And is your association with youth, is it enhanced or diminished by this death thing that stalks you?
I guess the great thing about being a doctor is that you start talking about medically young. So basically anyone under 65 is young. So that's great. I'm going to be young for quite a while. I guess every part of the age spectrum has a part to play in life. And I guess I've come to the point where I don't necessarily feel like a completely young person. You know, I don't know what's in the charts and things like that anymore. But we're still very active. We do lots of things. We go running. We go to gigs. I don't think, because I think about death quite a lot, I think about my own death. I do think about what it would be like if my husband died. I don't think that stops me taking advantage of where I am in life.